Okay. Just before we start, I wanted to clarify one thing to make sure that there was no misunderstanding. When I was imitating the monk doing a puja with the water and the everything there, I wasn't ridiculing the masters who do puja, because those people, you know, clearly know what they're doing, and they're are transforming their minds when they do the pujas and creating merit and purifying. What I was ridiculing was our very naive thing that the about that creating merit and purifying is something out there that somebody else does, and we can just sit there and have them create, you know, do the path for us. That's what I was making fun of. Okay. So let's cultivate our motivation. Once we have it, we can't be complacent, because it's not going to last forever. We're all in the process of aging and approaching death. Death is definite, although we don't know. We have no choice but to go. And all we can take with us is our karma, the seeds of the Dharma that have been planted in our mind stream, our body, our friends and relatives, our material possessions, all these things that preoccupy our life all stay here. The karma created from trying to procure them and protect them comes with us into our next life. So seeing this situation, we see that it's really imperative that we not waste our time, and that we put our energy into Dharma practice. So Dharma practice means to transform our mind, and the best thing to transform our mind into is the bodhicitta, the aspiration to attain full awakening in order to have the wisdom, compassion, and power to be of the greatest benefit to all living beings. So let's generate that bodhicitta motivation right now. even if it's fabricated, by generating it again and again, we reinforce it in our mind stream, and one day it will be spontaneous and really heartfelt. So sometimes then we go, oh, well, you know, I keep on saying the words, nothing's really happening, and, you know, I'm just phony baloney because I don't really feel it. But the thing is that we're very much creatures of habit, and what we're doing in Dharma practice a lot is establishing new habits. Right now, our ignorance, anger, and attachment, our non-virtuous actions are very habitual, simply because we keep doing them again and again and again. So we have to, again and again and again, think in the opposite way, plant the opposite kinds of seeds in our mind. So don't despair if you don't, you know, feel bodhicitta instantaneously all the time. Just be content to plant those seeds in your mind stream. Because we're really in the process of setting up new habits. And as we know, habits are deeply ingrained. So old habits, it's going to take them a while for us to uproot them. And new, very wholesome habits, it's going to take us a while to keep planting those seeds again and again in our mind stream. But if you do this, then over time you see the difference. If you say, oh, I'm not getting anywhere, and stop doing it, then, of course, you won't have any difference. Okay? It's like learning to play a musical instrument. Yeah? You ever had to play a musical instrument? Well, you know, you have to do it over and over and over. You have to practice the music. That's why we call it practice the Dharma, over and over and over again. And if you really practice your instrument, then you get good at it. But if you give up partway and say, you know, this is just not going as fast as I want it to go, or all these other people are better than I am, so there's no use in me doing anything. If you have those kind of defeatist attitudes, then your joyous effort is gone, and of course you're not going to get anywhere. Yeah, because you stop. So that's why joyous effort is really important, you know, and why having that long-term vision of where we're going in our practice is important. And it doesn't matter. Okay, it may take, you know, for the Sutrayana path, from the time you enter the path, which means for bodhisattvas, the time you have spontaneous bodhicitta, we're not even there yet. But from that point, it's three countless gradients. I go, oh, three countless gradients. You know, I can't even handle 3 days. Yeah. So, you know, that's just, you know, I won't even try. It's just too long, too hard. So you give up. So that's your choice. But what's going to happen if you give up? What's the alternative to practicing Dharma? It's getting old and sick and dying, and being born and getting old and sick and dying, and doing the same thing you've done since beginningless time. Is that a viable option? Is that really what you want to do? Of course not. Okay. So even if it takes a long time, even if it's hard, it doesn't matter, because we're going in the right direction. Instead of wandering in samsara from one rebirth to the next, up and down and across, and constantly having problems and stress and difficulties and misery, instead of that, at least we know we're going in a good direction. What a relief. Okay, so don't worry about how long it takes or how hard it is. Just rejoice that you met a path that works. Because think of all the people on this planet who haven't met the Dharma, or who have met the Dharma but don't have the karma to understand it. And instead, you know, they want what we were talking about yesterday, quick, easy, and cheap. Yeah. Or they want spirituality that is completely mixed in with having fun and being popular and making a lot of money. And so these people really go down the wrong path, because they can't distinguish what is virtue, what is non-virtue. No one's ever explained it to them. Or even somebody explained it to them, their mind is filled with doubt, you know, and their attachment to the happiness of this life is so strong. I mean, look at the ISIS soldiers. All these young people who joined the Islamic State army, and they think that by killing the infidels they'll be born in heaven. Yeah. Is killing virtuous? No. Is killing infidels gonna bring you a heavenly rebirth? Uh-uh. But they believe it will. So they have no compunction about killing people. They think it's good. The more infidels I kill, the better it is. Yeah. So they've even distorted their own religion, because Islam does not teach like that. They've distorted Islam. They aren't real Muslims. And they're just creating so much negative karma for future misery, even though they think what they're doing is fantastic. So it's really a sad situation when you think about that. And throughout history, if you studied history, I did when I was in school, and that was my major, in fact. And the one thing that I really saw was, you know, motivated by wrong views and motivated by greed, people again and again kill each other for no good reason at all. And in the process of harming others, they plant seeds of negative karma own mind streams and harm themselves. And this has happened in Europe. It happened like every generation, people killing each other in the name of religion. And religion is supposed to bring peace and happiness in the world. But people didn't understand their own religion properly, and in the name of religion, created enemies and killed others. It's quite sad, you know, we human beings have an amazing human intelligence. I mean, look what we can build. We can send rockets to the moon. In that way, we're very intelligent. But when it comes to ethical conduct, we're really rather backwards and rather stupid. You know? Because our wrong views, our negative emotions come and just overpower us, and off we go. You know? Being greedy and thinking that's the path to happiness, harming others and thinking that's going to get rid of our suffering, generating wrong views and thinking that will bring us good rebirth. So all that brilliant human intelligence that can create rockets to the moon and smartphones is like wasted. Because we can't even get the basic thing of ethical conduct right. Yeah. When you see this clearly, I mean, it's like you want to cry, because so many people's potential is just getting wasted, and they can't see it. And sometimes even you try and explain it to them, they get mad at you. So, that's samsara, and that's why we're trying to get out of samsara, because it's a really rock state of mind, and no matter what we do, we're never going to wind up with lasting happiness. So the Buddha was very compassionate in explaining all of this to us. We need to listen, we need to integrate those teachings in our mind through remembering them, contemplating them again and again and again, so that we really kind of reformat the hard disk of our way of thinking. Yeah. Unfortunately, you can't just press reformat and, you know, have a computer do it for you. You have to do it yourself with a lot of purification. But if we do that, we experience the good result. So we often talk in Buddhism about transforming our mind, that Dharma practice means transforming our mind. So what does that mean? What are we transforming our mind from? And transforming it into. Okay. So what we're trying to transform it from is ignorance, anger, and attachment. And our great familiarity with the 10 paths of non-virtue. And we're trying to transform it into love, compassion, bodhicitta, wisdom, and so on. So how do we transform our mind? This is the key. How do we transform our mind? What is this process of transformation? So I'll tell you a little story that my teachers told on the first Dharma course I went to. I think trace it back to Lama Tisha, who was a great Indian sage who went to Tibet in the 11th century. So Lama Tisha was watching one old man who was circumambulating a stupa. So normally we say that circumambulating a stupa, a Buddhist monument, is something virtuous. You know, we think of it as something good. So this man's walking around and around. And at one point, Lama Tisha stops him and says, "Oh, it's very good that you're circumambulating the stupa, but it would be even better if you practiced the Dharma." The man was very puzzled because he thought he was practicing the Dharma. So he thought, well, maybe circumambulating the stupa isn't it. Maybe I better bow and prostrate. So he, you know, got out his prostration board and he started prostrating to the stupa, prostrating and prostrating. Lots of prostrations. And then again, Lama Atisha stopped him and said, "Oh, it's very nice you prostrating to the Buddha. It would be better if you practiced the Dharma." Okay. So he didn't quite understand what was going on, but he thought, okay, I will read texts. So he pulled out a text and he's reading. Because you have the long text like this. Let me turn the page. And again, Lama Tisha comes to him and says, "Oh, it's very nice you're reciting sutras, but it would be better if you practiced the Dharma." Now the man is like frustrated. So he says, "What do you mean practice the Dharma?" And Atisha said, "Practicing the Dharma means transforming your mind." So why wasn't circumambulating transforming the mind? Why wasn't doing so many prostrations transforming the mind? Why wasn't reading the sutras transforming his mind? Because he was just doing the physical action, and he thought the physical action itself was the transformation. But it's not. Yeah. It's the motivation. It's having a good intention, making our mind virtuous. That's transforming our mind. Okay. So if you're walking around the stupa, but you're thinking of ice cream, ice cream. Okay, I'm going to walk around the stupa 10 times and I'm going to get some ice cream. I'm going to go see my boyfriend, my girlfriend. Yeah, I did a good job at work today. I hope I get that promotion and maybe another few $1,000s. But this, you know, colleague at work called me a name and I can't stand him. I want to get even. And so that's what you're thinking about while you're walking around the stupa. Are you practicing the Dharma? No. Your thoughts are just ordinary, afflicted, distracted garbage. Same thing. He was doing, he was working on his 100,000 prostrations. One, two. Okay, I do one prostration every 10 seconds. That means 6 prostrations in a minute. That means 360 prostrations in an hour. Then divide that by 100,000 and I'll know how many hours I have to prostrate. So his body is doing gymnastics and his mind is doing math problems. Is there any purification in that? Is there any mental transformation? He's just figuring out how long it's going to take him to do 100,000. And then in the middle he remembers, it's not 100,000, it's 111,111. Oh no, that's more hours. How many more hours do I have? Okay. Then same with reciting the sutras. Shariputra said, blah, 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 and everything's empty, and blah, 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 and my refrigerator's also empty. Yeah, not to mention my wallet. And, So, reading all the sutras, but that's not transforming the mind. Okay? So, when we're really transforming our mind, that's when our mind is under the influence of an affliction and we apply an antidote. That's when we're really practicing. Nobody else can see it. Okay? So, somebody at work criticized you. You're getting angry. So you sit down and you think, okay, I'm angry because they pointed out my faults. Well, I do have those faults, so why do I get angry if somebody pointed it out? I'm always saying I want to improve myself. Here's somebody else telling me how to improve myself. Why do I get angry at somebody who's helping me to improve? Shouldn't I put my palms together and say thank you? And then you realize, okay, there's really no need to get angry. If I have that fault, then I need to own it. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It doesn't mean I'm a failure. I made a mistake. I'll learn from it. I'll try to do better in the future. And I can have more compassion for other people who make that same mistake. Okay? And so you drop the anger, your mind is transformed, you're peaceful again. That is real Dharma practice. That is real Dharma practice. Yeah. Or you notice when you're walking down the street, oh, there's a mall. Let's walk through the mall. Oh, gee, that's really beautiful. Gee, there's so many beautiful things here. I want them. Yeah, then my house will be beautiful. Then everybody will think that I have such a good life, that I'm wealthy because I have all these beautiful things in my house. Yeah, so how can I save up enough money? Or maybe, how can I drop some hints so my parents give me some money? And then I can go out and buy all these things. And then my friends will be a little bit jealous. That's kind of cool. Just a little bit, not too jealous, because then there's problems. But I would really like my friends to envy me. Yeah. And then you realize, what's going on in my mind? A lot of attachment, a lot of greed. Yeah. I don't care anything about the environment. I'm using more than my fair share of the world's resources. I'm just thinking about my possessions and my reputation. And that's not going to get me anywhere. Yeah. Because all these things I'm craving, they're in style this year and out of style next year. And even if they aren't out of style, they're going to break. And when I die, I can't take them with me. So why am I so greedy for all these things? Actually, what I have in my house right now is completely good enough. Yeah? But I have functions. It may not be the most expensive, the most modern, the most beautiful, but it works, it functions. I'm content. That's real Dharma practice. At that time, because what you're doing is you're opposing your attachment and your greed. So nobody else necessarily knows you're even practicing Dharma at that time. You could be sitting on the MRT or in the bus, reflecting in this way and overcoming your attachment or your anger. Nobody knows, but that's okay. They don't need to know. The important thing is that you're mind is becoming more peaceful, and you're the one transforming it. So you're purifying, you're accumulating merit, you're applying the teachings to your life. Great, and you're experiencing a good result because of it. Be happy. So, having said that, let's go back to Shantideva's text here, because he has some things to say about this. So, in verse 15, this is where, 15 and 16, is where he's talking about abandoning the laziness of being very busy doing negative actions. Okay. So verse 15 says, having rejected the supreme joy of the sacred Dharma, which is a boundless source of delight, why am I distracted by the causes for pain? Why do I enjoy frivolous amusements and the like? Okay. So the Dharma which can bring, you know, when we practice it, continuous peace and joy in the mind and be a boundless source of delight, why are we giving this up and letting our mind be distracted by the causes for pain? But what are we doing? We're enjoying frivolous amusements and the like. Why is that? Why are those activities the cause of pain? Yeah. Somebody wrote me today, and he's writing an article for a German news Buddhist magazine, and he asked me questions about the smartphone. Yeah, and you know, how does smartphone fit into Buddhist practice? How does it relate to the fifth precept? Have you ever thought about that? How your smartphone relates to the fifth precept of not taking the tonsukas? Because you're usually not taking the toxicants. That's, you know, not taking illegal drugs, not drinking. How does a smartphone fit in there? Yeah, because a smartphone, it can be a huge distraction, can't it? You know? You completely get engrossed in your phone. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah, I could be practicing the Dharma, but let's look up Lama Atisha's life instead and see what years he lived from. Okay, he lived, you know, those years, and he lived in Tibet. Well, what's Tibet like? Oh, there's all these mountains in it, half of it. Oh, half of Mount Everest is in Tibet, and half is in Nepal. gee, my friends have gone to Nepal. I wonder how much it costs to fly to Nepal on a holiday. So you check that on your smartphone. Well, that's a really good idea. I want to go out to Nepal. Let's plan some dates so I can ask my boss for some leave. So you pull up the calendar on your smartphone and you start planning the dates. You know, oh, but my sister's getting married that day, so I can't be in Nepal. My sister's getting married. Gee, I wonder, she's having her wedding at this really nice hotel. I wonder how she's paying for it. Yeah? But she has this beautiful dress. Look, I can look and see where she's registered and see all of her engagement pictures. Isn't that cool? Look at my sister. She looks so good. One day, I want to be a bride too. Oh, yeah. Gee, what kind of dress do I want to wear when I get married? Let's check out the bridal sites. And then you go to the bridal sites. Well, if I want to get married, I need a guy. So I better sign up for one of those dating things, you know? So then you go and you check out a dating app. Okay. Hours and hours you spend doing this, right? Yeah? One thing leads to another. It's all distraction, isn't it? And what kind of mental states are fueling it? In this example, chiefly attachment, isn't it? Yeah? Thinking that pleasure exists outside and I have to possess it. Is your mind engaged in anything virtuous? It's completely self-centered. My happiness, my fantasy wedding, yeah, my fantasy boyfriend. Yeah. Do you check out the dating apps to find Buddha boy? But then you know that kind of, because you've watched enough people in relationships, you know that somehow, sometime Buddha boy turns into Mara boy. So then, okay, I better check out some of the sites for relationships and how to cultivate a good relationship. I better look up a counselor because sometime I'm going to need it. This Buddha boy is probably going to leave his dirty socks around the house and expect me to pick him up. I'm not going to put up with that from some guy. And then go into anger. Oh yeah, that reminds me of my last boyfriend. You know, he expected me to do this and this and this. He was a jerk. How did I manage to get involved with that one? Well, let's look at my Facebook pictures when I was involved. And I wonder what he's doing now. I should check this Facebook page and see. Yeah? And check Instagram. Oh my goodness, he's with somebody new. Oh my goodness. Yeah. I know I broke up with him, but he's not allowed to be with somebody new. And your mind is spinning into attachment and anger and competitiveness and jealousy. Okay? So Shantideva is asking the question, why am I distracted by the causes of pain? Because all this stuff that we're doing is involved with afflicted mental states, so we're creating negative karma. All this daydreaming is one huge negative karma festival. Okay? So why do I enjoy frivolous amusements and the like? Yeah, it's really not so good for me. And anyway, do I really enjoy it? Yeah. How much do you enjoy looking on Facebook to see what your ex is doing? That's not so much fun, is it? Better to go back to looking at the bridal pages. Yeah. But then how am I going to pay for them? I can't pay for the dress that looks like this one. So you see how much suffering all this brings? And at the end of the day, what do you have for it? You still don't have your wedding gown. You still don't have somebody to marry. You know, all you have is the vision of his dirty socks on the floor. Yeah, just like your last boyfriend. So, you know, better to turn the mind to the Dharma, isn't it? Isn't it? You're looking at me like I'm nuts. But the last boyfriend was really rotten. This one is going to be different. I know, my true love is out there waiting for me. Yeah. Do your parents have a good marriage? How many of you want a marriage like your parents' marriage? Think about it. Okay, 16. Without indulging in despondency, actually 16, here we're starting on the third kind of laziness, the laziness of despondency. Okay, so without indulging in despondency, I should gather the supports for enthusiasm and earnestly take control of myself. Then, by seeing the equality between self and others, I should practice exchanging self for others. Okay, so here, saying, you know, I'm going to stop having pity parties and feeling despondent and really take responsibility for my life and do something positive. And, you know, as I'm doing that, then I will do the meditation on the equality between self and others, which leads us to the meditation of exchanging self and others. So those two meditations are in chapter 8, the next chapter of this book. So I won't go into them now. If you want a preview in the book Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage, yeah, chapter 11, Geshe Jampa Tekchok has written a beautiful explanation of those meditations in it. Okay, verse 17. I should never indulge in despondency by entertaining such thoughts as, how shall I ever awaken? For the Tathagatas who speak what is true have uttered this truth. Which is verse 18. If they develop the strength of their exertion, even those who are flies, mosquitoes, bees, and insects will win the unsurpassable awakening, which is so hard to find. So what these two verses are saying is, there's no reason for me to be depressed or despondent or have a pity party or feeling sorry for myself and thinking that, you know, I just don't have all the good conditions and I'll never have all the good conditions and this whole thing is just, you know, so hopeless. That we should never start thinking that way, because the Tathagata, the Buddha, who says only what's true, said that even flies, mosquitoes, bees, and insects, including cockroaches, yeah, and cats, and mice, and rats, and your boss, and Donald Trump, that they can all one day attain unsurpassable awakening. Wow. I can handle the cockroaches. Well, the Buddha said, yeah, everybody has that clear light nature of the mind. Everyone has that potential. So the flies and mosquitoes and so on, in that particular lifetime, they're not going to be able to attain awakening. But after they have a precious human life, like we have at present, then they will be able to. So there's no sentient being who we can just give up on and say that they're hopeless. Because all of them have the Buddha potential, or the Buddha nature. All of them can become fully awakened. So if everybody else can, so can I. It's not like, you know, there's limitless living beings and they all have the Buddha nature and I'm the only one who doesn't. Yeah. I'm so special that I don't have the Buddha nature. Or I'm so special that I'm the only one with obstacles. Yeah. I have so many obstacles. I have this health problem, I have that health problem, I have a visa problem, I have problems with my parents, I have problems with my own mind concentrating, you know, I have money problems, I have this problem and that. I'm just full of problems. Yeah. And we sit there and, you know, develop single point of concentration on the perfection of complaining. Yeah? And for what purpose? It's like we're saying the Buddha's a liar. Yeah? Isn't it? When we say, I can't do it, what we're essentially saying is Buddha was lying when he said everybody can become awakened. Because we don't believe we can do it. So that means the Buddha was lying. Are you sure you want to say that the Buddha is lying? Are you sure you want to say that? Think about it. Yeah. If you don't want to say that the Buddha's lying, then you might have to accept the fact that you have the Buddha nature. And then you might have to accept that you're not hopeless and your situation is not all bad. And that you can do something. So verse 19. It will be so if I do not forsake the Bodhisattva's way of life. Why should someone like myself, who has been born into the human family, not attain awakening? Since I am able to recognize what is beneficial and what is of harm. Okay, so if I don't give up on myself, if I don't forsake the Bodhisattva practice, yeah, then I will be able to become awakened. Because I do have some intelligence, and I can figure out, and I can listen to the teachings and discern what is beneficial, what is virtuous, what is wholesome, what to practice, and what is not beneficial, what is not realistic, what is not wholesome, what I should abandon. And if I can do that, then there's a way for me to practice the path. And as I practice the path, my mind will get clearer, my wisdom stronger, I'll be able to do more and more. Okay, verse 20. Here, our self-centered thought comes up. Our self-centered thought says, but, nevertheless, it frightens me to think that I might have to give away my arms and legs. Because I've read all these stories, the Jataka tales, and in them, the Buddha gives up his head, he gives up his family, he gives up his arms and legs. I mean, remember the story? It took place in Nepal, where he offered his body to feed the tigress so that she could feed her cubs. And it's like, I don't want to offer my body to some big cat for lunch. You know, that's too scary. I'm happy to eat somebody else's body for lunch. But I don't want anybody to have my body for lunch. Because that causes me suffering. And yet, if I'm going to be a bodhisattva, I have to do that. No, I'm not going to do that. Anyway, my mother won't let me. Okay. But then Shantideva says to that argument, without discriminating what is heavy and what is light, I am reduced to fear through confusion. So why am I so frightened and confused by thinking about offering my arms and legs? It's because I don't really understand what the Buddha was talking about when he showed those examples of offering his body. I have some misunderstanding. Okay, so verse 21, we're going to get into the misunderstanding here and how to understand this practice of generosity correctly. For over countless myriad of eons, I have been cut, stabbed, burned, and flayed alive innumerable times, but I have not awakened. So this is what we're thinking. You know, why am I afraid of giving my body? Because in past lives I've, been cut and stabbed and burned and all these things, and all these different horrific rebirths I've had, but it hasn't gotten me anywhere. If I practice the bodhisattva path again, I'm just going to get cut and stabbed and burned, and it's not going to get me anywhere. So why should I do that? So that's a wrong conception. Okay, yeah. Yet the suffering involved in my awakening will have a limit. It is like the suffering of having an incision made in order to remove and destroy greater pain. So Shantideva is saying, yeah, all that suffering that we experienced in horrible rebirths in the past was of no use to us on the path of awakening, because we're still here. But, okay, the suffering involved in practicing the path to awakening does have a limit, and it does end, and it does produce a beneficial result. And so here, he makes an analogy between a doctor who has to operate on somebody who's ill. So if somebody's ill, the person needs surgery. Surgery is going to hurt, but you do the surgery because it's for the greater long-term good. Because if you have the surgery, then you've, gotten rid of the tumor, or you've corrected the broken bone or whatever it is, you'll eventually heal, and that pain was worthwhile because it will bring you to a better state of health afterwards. And so the same is in practicing the path. If sometimes we experience discomfort, it's not wasted, because by transforming our mind in doing those dharma activities, we will attain awakening. So, just as with a health problem, you experience some suffering for the greater good of recovery, in practicing the dharma, we may have to experience some suffering for the greater good of getting enlightened. Okay? So, when your back hurts and your knees hurt when you're meditating, you can know that it's not just fruitless endeavor, but your meditation is going to produce some good results. So don't just say, oh, my back hurts and my knees hurt, and so I'm never going to meditate again. Yeah, there's some discomfort, but it's worth it, because you'll be able to practice better and eventually become Buddha. 23, even doctors eliminate illness with unpleasant medical treatments. So in order to overcome manifold sufferings, I should be able to put up with some discomfort. So, you know, again, sometimes we're really silly. When it comes to making money, we will put up with a lot of discomfort. Yeah, you're tired in the morning. You still get up and go to work, don't you? Yeah. You don't say, oh, I'm too tired. If you have to get up and meditate in the morning, you say, I'm too tired, I'll do it tomorrow. But when it's, I have to go to work, yeah, you manage to get up. Why? That vision of your paycheck. I want that paycheck. So you're willing to endure the suffering to get the paycheck. Yeah. When you're in school, to get the skills so you can do your job, you have to study, you have to take O levels and A levels and write all sorts of papers and, you know, study until 3 o'clock in the morning and take these exams, but you do it. Why? So that I can get a good job and make some money. So we can put up with suffering. We can put up with suffering. And we do put up with a lot of suffering. But we're putting up with the wrong kind of suffering. Yeah. When it comes to practicing the Dharma, we aren't willing to be in the least bit uncomfortable. Yeah. We have to be continuously comfortable. Yeah. We'll go to our classes at school, even though they don't serve refreshments. But we go to the Dharma Center because they serve refreshments. So we somehow have to change this, you know, and have a little bit more fortitude. Yet the supreme physician, the Buddha, does not employ common medical treatments such as these. With an extremely gentle technique, he remedies all the great ills. So the Buddha is not going to do major surgery on your body and, you know, dissect you. But he gives common sense Dharma practices that correspond to the level that we're at. Okay? At the beginning, so here's what he does, here's what the Buddha does. At the beginning, the guide of the world encourages the giving of such things as food. Yeah? So at the very beginning, the Buddha doesn't ask us to give our body to the tiger. He encourages us to give food. Yeah? That's something that's pretty easy to give, isn't it? In our world, people share food all the time. It's one of the basic things we do with other living beings is to eat together and to share our food. Yeah. So that's not real difficult. Later, when accustomed to this, one may progressively start to give away even one's flesh. So at the beginning, Buddha doesn't say, give away your body. Yeah. He says, give away an apple. And there's the story of one old lady who, she was really stingy. She didn't want to give anything. So the Buddha gave her a carrot and had her practice giving the carrot from one hand to the other hand. Yeah? Just so she could practice giving and letting go. And when she got used to giving herself the carrot, eventually she was able to place it in the hand of somebody else. Okay, so you can see how slowly progress takes place. At such a time when my mind is developed to the point of regarding my body like food, then what hardship would there be when it comes to giving away my flesh? Yeah, so when I've practiced generosity, again and again and again, and I'm very detached from my body, whereby giving away my body is like giving away an apple, then I can give my body and I won't have any pain. I won't have any fear or regrets. Yeah, it won't seem like a dangerous situation to me because I will have practiced all this kind of generosity beforehand and I'll be quite prepared to do that. So verse 27 says, having forsaken all transgression, there would be no suffering. Okay? So when a bodhisattva gives up creating negative karma, then they will never experience physical suffering, even if they give their body, because they've stopped creating negative karma and have purified their negative karma. And due to wisdom, there would be no lack of joy. So when bodhisattvas develop wisdom, then there's no reluctance in giving their body. You know, they feel mentally happy and delighted. So even if they remain in cyclic existence for the sake of others, why would the compassionate ones ever be upset? Yeah. So when bodhisattvas take rebirth in cyclic existence for our benefit, even though they see all of cyclic existence as like a hellhole, they don't have any suffering because they haven't created the negative karma that brings suffering, physical suffering, and because they have wisdom, so they're free of mental suffering. Yeah. And so, you know, they're never upset. And so we can get to that point too. It's not impossible. It's quite possible. Okay. 29. Due to the strength of the awakening mind, the bodhisattvas consume their previous transgression. Okay, so they're purifying all their negative karma due to the power of their virtuous actions done with bodhicitta. And they consume their previous transgressions and harvest oceans of merit. Hence, they are said to excel the Shravakas. So the Shravakas are those who want to become arhats, but they're interested in their own liberation. So here it's really saying that the bodhisattva practice is superior because of their altruistic intention. And verse 31, so having mounted the horse of an awakening mind of bodhicitta that dispels all discouragement and weariness, who, when they know of this mind that proceeds from joy to joy, will ever lapse into despondency. So when we know the happiness that comes from generating bodhicitta, yeah, from having that virtuous mental state, from really committing ourselves to the path and to the benefiting other living beings, and because of that, we proceed from joy to joy. Once we're in that situation, how are we ever going to get despondent? Impossible. And so knowing that we can attain that situation for ourselves, why get despondent now? Yeah. So let's go forward in our practice and do something really good and something very meaningful with our lives. So with that, we will pause this year. And I think you have enough to contemplate now until next year, maybe. You know, there's a lot in it. We just did 30 verses, but there's a lot in this, isn't there? And so go through that, contemplate what you learn. If you have a chance, watch the videos from before. Yeah, catch up with the whole text. And then next year we can continue on, starting with verse 31. Okay. So, I think there's things we have to do this evening. So I think we'll skip the Q&A. Is that okay with you?
Oh, there's actually a question on the table, Venerable.
Okay. So essentially what this person is asking is they have a bad temper and year after year they get angry. Okay. And other people start saying, well, so-and-so, you know, they get angry and upset really easily. So does that mean that when we cultivate this habit of anger, we have not contemplated or meditated enough on the disadvantages of anger within ourselves? What's the answer to that question? Yes. Okay. And also, we haven't understood the cause and effect, that in the long run, this habit will sow seeds for the worst, for the next rebirth. So does having that habit and acting that out indicate that we haven't understood the cause and effect, that in the long term our anger is going to lead us to a bad rebirth? What's the answer to that question? Yes. Okay. So what does that mean? We have to contemplate these things again and again and again. Plant the seeds in our mind. Okay, so just a short meditation. Think about what you've heard so that you can remember it and put it into practice in your life. Let's rejoice at the merit we created this evening as individuals and as a group. Rejoice at all the goodness in the world and all the virtues of the arhats, bodhisattvas, and buddhas. Imagine all that merit as a bright light in the center of your chest, and send that out into all the corners of the universe where there's suffering sentient beings. And that light, that merit, that compassion radiating from your chest touches all living beings and pacifies their mind. Dissolves the fear of those who are afraid. Gives the requisites to whoever is impoverished. And makes the mind of each sentient being receptive to the Dharma. And gives them all the proper conditions that they can practice, gain the realizations of the path, and become Buddhas themselves. due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind